Welcome back to the Kingsman Podcast. I am your host, Simon Yu, and my partner in crime,
Joey Allen Lee.
So today we'll be discussing, we're going to bridge Christian ideas with the Disney Plus show Andor. And the reason why we felt compelled to share it is because, you know, we had a disagreement, didn't we, Joey? At first, you weren't really fond of the show.
It's a stupid show.
No, I disagree. And I loved it from the very get-go. I loved it. But we texted back and forth, and we had a disagreement, you know? And so, but now you've converted. You've enjoyed the show. And so let's start off with that. What convinced you to say, you know what? The prestigious doctor, Joey Allen Lee, was wrong.
Okay, lighten up there.
Just kidding. Okay, my bad. Just kidding. But yeah, why do you like the show so much now?
Well, my original gripe about Andor was that he was a nobody. Like, who cares about this guy? I've never heard of him before this, before Rogue One, you know? And why is everybody so interested in him, right? Like, you have the Imperial soldiers interested in him. You have the heist team who's interested in him. Everybody wants to go and capture this guy. For what reason? Like, what has he done? He hasn't done anything. Like, at least, I mean, he's not a good person, but like, I didn't see the significance in him, right? And I have to give credit to all those YouTube channels who do commentary on Andor and shows like that. And I don't remember which channel it said, but they said that this is exactly the perspective that we've never had in Star Wars. In Star Wars, we've only followed celebrities like Luke Skywalker or Han Solo or The Mandalorian, you know, big name characters, right? But we've never seen the Empire or we've never seen the Rebellion from the ground, from the perspective of a nobody. And I was like, hey, I like that perspective because I'm a nobody, because nobody cares about, you know, Dr. Joey Allen Lee. Nobody cares. Like, his perspective is meaningless. It's insignificant. And that's the perspective I wanted.
That's not true.
Well,
that's not true.
That's what the Empire tells me. You know?
That's what the Empire. Yeah, there you go. Exactly. Yeah.
We're just
hogs in the Empire machine. And you're right.
Everybody talks about how Andor is a slow build, and they're right. It is a slow build. I didn't begin to like it until the prison Narkeena 5.
Oh,
arc.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because I started to identify with the characters who are poor, vulnerable, marginalized, oppressed, mistreated. And I was like, hey, this is exactly what I want to be talking about. This is the theology of liberation that I have studied in school, in the scriptures, and now it's in a show on Disney Plus.
And it's done so well, right? You know, I feel that message of the marginalized and the mistreated and the overlooked and the downtrodden is a very popular theme and popular idea in storytelling in Western culture, right? Especially right now, right? But I think Andor did it so well. So I kind of agreed with you. It was a slow burn, and the obscurity is definitely there. Like what launched that? But you're at the prison arc is like, it clinched it. Right. And I totally agree with that. So, well then let's talk about it. The layering of Christian ideas, liberation, and the theological significance of that. But let's talk about some abstract ideas first. And you wanted to bring up the concept of evil. And how does Andor speak about that abstract idea of evil for you, Joey?
Obviously, the events that happen in Andor occur in a galaxy far, far away. And yet it seems so close to home.
Right.
Like it just happens here in our everyday lives, right? Like, we've never seen the rebellion from the ground, and we've never seen the inner workings of the Empire, you know, within like inter-office corporate, you know, conflict.
Yeah.
And you see employees trying to one-up each other, not because they're evil. They're just trying to, you know, get ahead. They're trying to climb the ladder. Have very down-to-earth motives, like the Deputy Inspector Karn. He has a judgmental mom, and so he's trying to succeed to, in some ways, like, please his mother or to, you know, prove her wrong, right? That's so relatable. It's relatable not just to me, but to, like, you know, anybody out there, right? Like, anybody who's had judgmental parents know what it's like to want to be successful and ambitious. And so, is that evil? Not necessarily, but you can become a cog in the machine, you know? And I'm right. Literally, I'm thinking about the prisoners on Narquina 5. Like, they pursue excellence. They want to be in the top of the scorecard, right? It's a competition. Is there anything wrong with being excellent? No. Is there anything wrong to be one of the winners, to have a good night, to not be tortured? Like, yeah, those are all fine motives, right? Nothing wrong with that. But they don't know what their excellence is for. They're literally cogs in the Empire's machines. They are creating actual devices that plug into the Death Star, right?
That's right. The actual cannon. Yeah.
And so, you know, I see this in everyday life. Just like everybody is just trying to do their thing, trying to make a living, trying to get ahead, trying to make sure they don't get left behind. And in small, subtle, unnoticeable ways, we can contribute to like the destruction of our world or the destruction of a peoples. And so the show, it makes evil so normal, you know?
Yeah, wow.
And it's crazy how complicit we can be because we're asleep, because we're just content with just taking their money and being left alone. But we're and I'm just taking from various speeches throughout the show, but the Empire is choking us so slowly that we don't even notice it anymore, you know? So let's just leave that as my initial thought on evil, that it's everywhere and it's pretty mundane.
Yeah. You're right. It is a difficult question because so many people throughout history have attempted to answer. And I guess a part of it is not satisfying. We understand evil. It's just hard to define it, right? Like when it happens to me, it's like, oh man, that is evil, right? And so like, or when we observe it in an anecdotal or experiential moment, it's like, yeah. And so it's difficult to explain, but it's not difficult to feel. Right. I've been reading St. Augustine and his book called The Enchiridion. And he was saying exactly what you were saying, is doing your best in a prison factory so that you could have that score so that you don't get electrocuted at the end of the day. You know, like, is that necessarily evil? No. But like what they're doing as part of that machine, the outcome is evil. Right. And so so what I believe what Augustine is saying, like, a lot of the things that we claim as evil is not necessarily evil in and of itself, just to get on top, you know, as the corporate ladder, right, is in and of itself evil. But the motive behind it, that's evil. And that's what makes it so difficult to define and pinpoint, to say, oh, this thing is evil, because it's so wrapped around with the mundane, you know. Yeah. And so it's just like, and it's hard to expose motive. It is. It's really hard to expose motive. You know, we as outsiders watching the story, we know it's evil. Why? Because the Emperor is a Sith Lord, and like we know the motive, right? And stuff and whatnot. But if you were like, if you were Cassian and you were just like, were the bottom rungs of the hierarchical totem pole, we don't know. We don't know. And so I think you're absolutely right.
Yeah.
But a manifestation of that evil, I would dare say even ultimate manifestation of that evil, is the building of empire. And that was really intriguing to me. And I loved, and you brought it, like the intricacies and the inner workings of an empire. We did not see that in any of the episodes of 1 through 9. We never really saw the inner workings as well as we did in this show, which I loved. But one of the questions I wanted to ask was, how does Andor show what the empire looks like in the Star Wars universe? Basically, it's a hyper-centralized ruling power, right? And so instead of a Senate and instead of local governing bodies, you have this charismatic figure of a Sith Lord running the show, but then everyone's kind of like beckoned to him, right? It's this hyper-centralized power that's been it's been consolidated, if you will. But a consequence of that, it's a homogenization of culture, of everything. It's homogenizing everything. Consequentially, there's always going to be conflict because there's a demand to make everything the same.
Yeah.
And there's going to be conflict. There's like, well, I don't agree with this way, or I don't agree with that way. And that conflict will always happen. And the problem with Empire is that you're going to have all the firepower on your end because you're consolidating all the power, right? And so it's just like when a conflict comes, most times than not, it's not going to let's discuss this. Let's debate, right? No, it's like I have the bigger gun. And so you better homogenize to my vision, if you will, the empire's vision, you know? And that's the problem I see when an empire hyper-centralized the power. And it's inevitable. That's what empires do, you know?
Yeah.
The use of violence is excusable in that point, where it's just like, hey, they're threatening the stability of the empire. Of course they're the enemy, you know? And so we have to use violence if that is the case, right?
Yeah. Yeah, I have an example of that. After the robbery, right? The high commander guy comes into like the imperial corporate office and they have that big meeting, right? And he says this. He says the use of any local custom, festival, or tradition as cover for rebel activity will trigger permanent revocation of imperial tolerance. And I just thought, that's cruel. You're telling people that they can't keep their heritage? They can't keep distinct cultural heritage that they have? Like, that's erasing what makes them unique, what's special, their story, right? And this is how the empire homogenizes it. And the crazy part of it is that he calls it imperial tolerance. You can keep your distinct customs because we tolerate it.
Yeah.
But as soon as you try to, use those unique things for rebel activity to oppose the empire will no longer tolerate it. You know, it's so crazy. Right. It's so backwards. Like you can be yourself.
Right.
As long as you don't cause us trouble.
That's exactly it. It is cruel and it's abusive. It's just like the only reason why you can keep your individualized identity is because we just simply allow it, you know? And so this homogeneity in the Star Wars universe, it's effectively operates as a secular and human-driven, human-focused empire. You know what I'm saying? Like, they don't like the distinctions of their rituals. They don't like, they really belittle it. And the whole Aldani train robbery arc, you know, I think it was the same guy that you quoted. You can just tell from the tone of his voice that he thinks that their rituals are so backwards and not sophisticated enough.
Yeah.
It's not sterile enough, you know, because it's just dirty. And that was disgusting. Mm. Like, you know, when they were passing the fleece to him as part of the ritual, and he's just like, I don't want to touch this thing. This is dirty. And I was just like, you don't get it. So an empire, because innately it's homogenizing, most times than not, it's going to be sterile. And often it's going to be secular because a lot of the distinctions of human beings is religious driven, right? Like the reason why many of us are so different is a lot of it is rooted in religiosity, in ritual of religion and stuff like that. And so even though it's like a theocratic empire because of the Sith Lord that's running the show and everything, the way that it functions is very secular. And notice all the people in the empire are human. There's no alien life forms in the empire. It's a very homogeneous carbon copy of everyone else. They all look the same, you know?
I think we should be careful with terms here, right? Just because it's secular doesn't mean it's bad. And just because it's religious doesn't mean it's good. I've seen lots of religions acting this way, acting cruelly.
That's exactly right.
Religious people can be very homogenizing.
Yeah.
Control freaks. Evangelical Christians are no different, right? Like we try to mold new converts into our own image and they have to abandon their old selves in order to be accepted in God's kingdom, right?
Yeah.
I feel like for a religion to be healthy and good, you have to try to accept people who are different from you, you know?
That's right.
That's hard. That's hard. And I think one of those sick things that you see in this show is that the ISB, what does ISB stand for? Like, the security bureau, right?
It's the Internal Security Bureau.
And he asks his team, what do we do here? And they say, oh, we're about security. And he says, security is an illusion. We are healthcare providers. We locate germs within or outside of our organization. Our job is to diagnose disorders. And I just thought, that's so crazy that you associate people who are not like you as germs. People who... You're basically calling anybody who is a dissenter, some kind of bacteria or virus that needs to be eradicated. And all of this is a euphemism, right? Like the empire sees itself as a clean, sanitary,
sterile
place. I think George Lucas purposely makes it so that the bad guys were white and the good guys are like grungy, brown, dark, you know, clothes, you know, and it's funny
earth
how
tones, earth
it's,
tones.
It's what the empire tells itself that it's clean and good and safe.
Yeah.
But the methods that they use are horrible.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And like you said, they use violence because it's necessary. They don't think of themselves as eradicating people, human beings with sacred dignity. Ooh, they tell themselves they are eradicating germs.
They dehumanize. That's right.
That's right.
Exactly right.
They dehumanize people. And by dehumanizing them, they tell themselves that it's okay to use the methods that they use.
That's right. Exactly. And we see that throughout our history, unfortunately. And it makes this such a great show because of how it connects in these really clever ways, like reflections of our past and reflections of our current situation right now. And we see it in episode 3, where Padme says, "So is this how a republic ends? By a crowd and applause?" I'm butchering her quote. Yeah. But like, the scary thing is the veneer of empire looks good but for the masses, right? And a lot of times, empire-driven movements, even though they might not admit that they're an empire, that tendency is blanketed by a facade of, hey, we'll provide for you. For like the lowly, it's just like, hey, we'll give you A, B, and C. It's an exchange. Ultimately, it's an exchange. The masses allow empire because the empire believes that it provides efficiency, security, employment, provision. It's like, hey, if you help us put this emperor in place, if you help us make it so we can consolidate our power and homogenize, we'll provide you these things, you know? But the problem with that is we'll provide you these things on our terms. So it's never enough because the whole idea, unfortunately, the consolidating of power and the consolidating of resources, like the problem is who does the distributing, right? It's just like, and like, if you're an empire driven by greed, anger, and all that, it's just like, no one's going to be taken care of in that regard. It's just going to be just a shy little bit of, and it's going to be demeaning because of that, you know? And so, and I feel that collectively, the entire story corpus of Star Wars, of the Star Wars universe thus far, the history of it, it seems like the people were duped and deceived, but it's just like, hey, we want the security. We don't want the war anymore, even though that war was supplanted by the Sith Lord. Like, we don't want this. We want more control. We want prosperity. We want peace. We want provision. If the Empire is providing that, sign me up. You know, that was the beginning. Yeah. And now they're feeling the lie of it. You know,
The local commandant with the Donnies, he calls them simple people. He said that what the Empire has done is you give them so many options that they don't realize that you're giving them nothing they wanted in the first place.
Right.
Wow. Yeah. So I feel like he's talking about us, like the common folk, right? I just think about how consumeristic and materialistic we are as an American society. We have been, and I'm not blaming like the American government or like, you know, capitalism at large. You know, I'm saying that sin and evil have a way of confusing us by giving us too many options. And so we get stuck choosing options when none of those options give us life, give us joy, you know?
Right. Right.
And we get duped. Exactly what you're saying. We get duped into this carnival game, you know, and they only give us trinkets in return.
That's right.
And the crazy thing is, as the Donnies migrate up the mountain range, the Empire installs comfort stations with cheap beverages. And so the multitude of 500, by the time they get to the top, it gets to 60 people, right?
Yeah, exactly.
And I think this is such a great parable for like the journey towards God, you know?
Yeah.
We might start out like at the bottom of the mountain, trying to ascend the mountain of God, you know? But along the way, you know, like the enemy, they put comfort stations there for us. They give us cheap beverages and we're content to like, oh, let's take a break. I'm just taking a break.
Exactly.
I'm still going to go.
Yeah.
And the break becomes an extended stay, and the extended stay becomes a, you know, permanent exile, you know?
Yeah.
And it's all because we are easily tempted, drugged with opiates, sold things that we don't want or need. And in the end, that's how the devil works. Sometimes, you know, if you ever read the Screwtape Letters, demons don't always like oppose God outright. All they say is, yeah, go ahead, pursue God, but let's have lunch first. Let's go shopping first. You know, they distract us with nothing.
Right.
And by doing that, we don't truly live. And that's what the empire does.
You know, one of the key examples I can think of that what Satan, he doesn't oppose outright, he tantalizes, was the wilderness scene with Jesus. You know what I'm saying? The temptations. And I believe it was Luke. It's like, you're hungry, Jesus. You shouldn't be hungry. The Son of God shouldn't be hungry. You have power. So use your power selfishly to feed yourself. What's wrong with that? There's nothing wrong with that. You shouldn't be hungry, you know? And you have the power to make these stones become bread, right? That's exactly how Satan does it. It's not like he fear-mongers. I mean, he could. He really could. But like he doesn't for majority of us because we don't need that motivation. All we need is that distraction of the options. I liked how you said it, of the so many options, you know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That's very true.
Yeah.
And that's and the Empire in Star Wars definitely showcases that in that Aldani arc, you know.
And I think the reason why I began to like the show so much is because I saw myself in Cassian. Right?
Mm.
He starts off not a believer in the rebellion cause, right? He's just trying to take care of himself and survive, right? But by the end of the movie, you see him convert, but it comes in fits and starts, and you clearly see that things happen to him that change him. I don't remember which episode it was, but Cassian, he finishes the robbery, and he comes back with a ton of money, and he's trying to pick up his mom, right?
Right.
He says to her, "Let's get out of the cold and the damp, and find somewhere warm and easy." What do we need but
ourselves?
Now, there is nothing wrong with trying to escape the cold and damp and to find somewhere warm and easy. At this point in the story, Cassian just wants to take care of himself and his mom. He loves his mom and maybe his robot B. So there is nothing wrong with wanting safety and security, right? But his mom, Marva, she's not content with that anymore. She literally says, "I've been lying around waiting to die long enough." And I think so many of us are just waiting around to die. We entertain ourselves with amusements. We distract ourselves with things, you know, but we don't pursue something that's truly meaningful, that's worth living for and dying for, you know?
Wow.
And it's so funny because when she says that she's going to stand up and take on the empire, you know what she does? She waters her plants. She stays in place in her house and she waters her potted plants.
Interesting.
And and she's willing to do whatever it takes. And she's not judging Cassian for taking a different path.
Yeah.
But she's like, "I'm gonna stay and do whatever it takes to not let the empire take a hold of my life." You know?
Right.
I'm not gonna let them make me afraid. Because for 13 years she's avoided the road that her husband was hung on, you know?
Yeah.
And I think, you know, like, dude, what a crazy parable about what happens to us, how we're just like Cassian. We're content to just try to take care of ourselves. But I think by the end, Marva, you know, in her final speech, she's not content to just take care of herself anymore.
Mm.
Right? She grows, her heart expands so that she cares about all of Ferrix, you know? And I think that's kind of like that spiritual actualization that I think God wants us to go through, to go beyond caring for oneself and one's loved ones and to start to care about our neighbor. Yeah. And that's rebellion, according to the
Empire. Yes.
But in Christian terms, that's just called love.
That's called the Christian duty. Right. Yeah, absolutely. I love what you said about Marva. I didn't see that keen insight about her planting, her watering her plants the moment after she says, I'm going to step up, rise up against the Empire. Her actualization at that moment made her live again, if you will, right? Instead of just sitting down and waiting, you know, we often think we need big changes to change big things, right? You know, but for her, it was just watering a plant. And that's profound to me. That's profound to me because, and you see the growth of that actualization. She was a sister of Ferrex. I want to bring that up.
Daughter of
Ferrex. I love that group. Oh, daughter of Ferrex. Yeah. The daughter of Ferrex. And that how, and she was a previous president. She like slacked on that. And then she kind of got activated again. It's just, it is very true to, it reminds me of the parable of the sower, you know, where like her heart has become the good soil for it to grow and all that. And then Cassian's heart, is the one stifled with the thorns of riches and well-being and all that, you know, and it's just like, we often think that the troubles, it's the troubles that turn away us from God. Often as most people, and I think this is the key insight of the parable of the sower is, what Jesus is saying is like, no, often most of us, we get distracted by pursuing the baubles and the jewels of the world, you know, and that's what the thorns are, you know, but Marva, she's like, no, I'm ripping those away. It's no more.
Yeah. So, there's something rebellious about her act of watering plants because she's keeping life alive.
That's right.
Whereas the Empire just wants to exterminate life. They don't want to suppress people, you know, and she's watering plants, you know, and I just see like it's an act of hope. Why would you water a plant if you thought it would die? Right?
Yeah.
You only water something if you believe that it will grow. And, you know, in her final speech to Ferrex, she tells him, I want you to go on. I want Ferrex to continue. And she said that if she could do it all over again, she'd be fighting the bastards from the start.
You know? That's right.
And I just feel like this is the way sin and evil works in our lives. Like it creeps in on us subtly in a way where we don't notice it until it's too late, where our lives are corrupted, our lives are ruined, and we believe that it's over, that we should just lie down and let the Empire continue. And what Marva prophetically is saying, I think, is no, the time to resist is now. Don't let it grow. Her speech, her final speech was just like, it gave me chills. She said that we've been sleeping. There is a wound that won't heal at the center of the galaxy. A darkness reaching like rust reaching into everything around us. We let it grow and now it's here and it's not visiting anymore. It wants to stay. The Empire is a disease that thrives in darkness. It is never more alive when we sleep. Dude, is such good writing.
Yeah. Oh my gosh. So she has true spiritual eyes, right? We talked about previously, like the motive and the drive of the Empire. What did that guy say? What are we? We're health providers. Empire vision folks think that this tyranny and oppression is necessary because we need to heal. We need to provide the medicine. And Marva, who has the right spiritual eyes, is like, no, you're the disease. You're the cancer, you know? Yeah. And
no, that's a good contrast.
That's really on point, Joey. Her final words are absolutely chilling. And it's not part of her funerary speech, but I also just want to add, like, what's the core center of that speech? This burly worker dude.
I think his name is Brassos.
He acts like a big brother to Cassian, but like he relays the final words to Cassian because Cassian didn't see Marva pass on, right? And one thing he says that I absolutely love, he says, there's no words that Cassian can say that will affect my love for him. And I'm just like, golly. And I'm just like, that's where her heart is, right? And just how even adopting him, you know what I'm saying? Is, you know, just like that kind of background, the background tale of adoption of him is just like, yeah, we're taking care of this kid. And it's just like, and Clem is like, we should go. It's like, nope, we're going to take care of this kid. And I'm just like, geez. And it's just like from the beginning to the end, it's just her love was actuated. You know what I'm saying? And that was incredible to see. So all to say, you brought up about the Empire wanting to destroy and all this and that. I'm going to add a little emendation on that a little bit. I don't think their intent was to destroy. I think a lot of people felt in the Empire is like, hey, we're doing a good thing. I think the problem with Empire is they want to conform life to their image. And that's scary.
Yeah.
And I think that's the problem. The Empire spirit, and I'll dare say that demonic Empire spirit, creeps into, like you said, in religious people, in anyone. Why is it so problematic? It's because, and I want to quote Nemec's manifesto, Imperial need for control is so desperate because it's so unnatural. Tyranny requires constant effort. It breaks, it leaks. Authority is brittle. This tyrannical authority is so brittle. Oppression is the mask of fear. The demonic spirit of Empire is the ultimate form of idolatry.
Mm.
It's idolatry, right? The need for control is unnatural because absolute control is only God. Yeah. Only God can do that, right? And what people who think that we need to have this empire, we need to have this consolidation of power, they won't admit it in the beginning, but basically it says, I don't believe what God is doing and the way he controls things is adequate. I need to do it.
Mm-hmm.
I need to do it, right? And what does that make you become? You think you're better than God, or you think that empire demonic spirit thinks that they're better than God to do the things, right? And so because of that, that's why I say this is the ultimate form of idolatry. When a human needs control, it leads to tyranny and oppressive authority, and it's driven by fear because they're afraid of losing it, right? And so it's like the snake eating itself kind of chaos, where you use fear to control people because you're afraid that they're going to take you out. They're going to move you out. So it's this back and forth with fear, right? Because of this, the human becomes less human, right? And so, you know, there's a lot of people who say when they do bad things, they just justify it. It's like, well, I'm only human, because the presupposition is that humans make mistakes and stuff like that. But in Christianity, the idea is that because Christ was the ultimate perfect example of what human is, he is the true human.
Yeah.
He's the true divine, and he's the true human. And that every human creature looks up to him, become more human. And I think that what Marvel was, she became more human, you know? She became more human when her love was actualized and she wanted to fight against this empire disease, this demonic power, right?
Yeah.
She became more human. Everyone are subhumans. Empire people are subhumans. They're walking away from being human, you know? And that's what idolatry does. And that's what this empire drive does, that sense of tyranny and control, is become you less and less human. You're walking away from the light of humanity, which is Christ.
Yeah. Yeah. Absolutely all true. Very Christian of you, Simon. Marva was stepping into theosis, right? She was becoming more like God,
right?
Participating in the divine being, right?
Exactly.
But on a ground level, like Dedra Mira, right?
Dedra Mira.
She doesn't see herself as becoming subhuman, right?
Right.
She's just telling herself, I'm a diligent, thorough worker, employee, trying to get ahead to get the most tasks done and the best tasks done, right? And in her mind, she's trying to be ethical, trying to do the right thing. There's a certain level of self-righteousness there. But I think, you know, what's the beauty of Andor here is that we see that the Empire is a well-oiled machine, but the employees backstab each other. They undermine each other. And the Empire rises by destroying each other.
Yeah.
Dang. And that's the way that sin and evil work. Everybody wants to be on top, so everyone drags the other person down. And that is completely opposite to how love and peace should work, at least within the Christian sense. At least in the Christian community, what should ideally happen, and I'm not saying it always happens, is that individuals become selfless and seek to build the other up. And by doing so, everybody rises together. Like in our everyday practices, do we try to build another person up, our coworkers up, or do we backstab them to try to step on them?
You're right. You and I experienced it in our times of leadership in certain churches of just the abuse in Christian circles. But the idea of the Christian message in and of itself, the pure love of it, is not abusive. It's an infiltration of, well, one, we're just human individuals still corrupted by sin, and still the residue of sin is still there. And sometimes it creeps in. But like that gospel message in and of itself should be the thing that defies and breaks that tendency that we have. There's a fancy word. It's called cupiscence. And St. Augustine uses it a lot. But the idea is that though we're not marred like Adam with original sin, we have the tendency more so to sin rather than to not sin, you know. But because of Christ and the way he infiltrated our world, we can stand up to it, not on our own, but with the partnership of the Trinity and his mercy and so forth. And so the question is, why do some Christian communities fall to the tantalizations of empires and some break out of it, right?
That's the million-dollar question.
That's the million-dollar question, exactly. And I think I'll take a stab at the answer. I think is the idea of religious ritual. What is ritual? In the most mundane sense, it's something that's done over and over again, right? So you have a morning ritual. I have an evening ritual, you know, and we have certain rituals that we do. But in a religious sense, it's this beautiful mechanism. It's traditional, meaning that it's a way for present to connect to the past. It's a thing that's been passed down generation to generation that present people can experience with the people of the past, right? It's didactic. A part of good religious ritual is that it teaches something, and it doesn't have to teach something new or different over and over again. It could be the same thing every week over and over again, right? It's didactic, right? It's multi-sensory. It's not just your hearing or your visuals that are being activated, but it's your sense of smell, your taste, everything makes it a better ritual. And then ultimately it's communal. It's not just me individually as a Christian person that I do on my own. I participate with other people, right? It's the individual connects with the community, right? And so that's what I mean what I about religious ritual. I see that in Andor. See, the way that the first season breaks down is like an imperfect chiasm. And it's like, and what is a chiasm? It's a literary style that you see it over and over again in the Bible. But it's basically, if you have a passage, the center passage is the most important. And then all the concentric passages around that will connect to one another, right? I see Andor first season as a chiasm. Not a perfect one, but a chiasm where that prison arc is the main story. It's the main message of Andor. And then on top of that was the Aldani story. And below that was the Ferrix uprising, right? And the Aldani and the Ferrix uprising, one key component in both of them is the ritual. The Aldani ritual of seeing the eye, the pilgrimage of the eye. And then the Ferrix ritual, which was the funerary procession. All of them were religious in nature based off the characteristics that I've said. Multisensory, didactic, traditional, and communal, right? And I feel that the idea here, and again, I don't know if Tony Gilroy is a religious person or what, but I think he really nailed it where like the key message of the, which I think is Exodus, bro. I think the prison narrative is Exodus in and of itself, right? And then surrounding that is the ritual. So like, if you have a good, solid message and wrap it around with ritual, that's beautiful. That's powerful right there. And the empire does not like it. The empire hates it. The empire fears it. Why? They belittle it, you know, to a certain extent, but that belittling is because they fear it. Why? Because I feel that these religious rituals are so distinct to the individual that they are defiant to the homogenizing force that is empire. You know what I'm saying? And the key example of that was when they do the funerary procession, and part of the funerary procession is they burn the dead and they make them into a brick. And so, and then they put that brick as like a cornerstone foundation of their buildings. It's powerful.
So powerful.
It's absolutely, it's so powerful that you are part of that community. Your death doesn't mean that you're separate from that community. Yeah. The dead build the community.
I know.
The dead shelter the community. It's so unbelievable.
When I die,
amazing.
I want
so
to
good.
Be built into a brick. And that
brick
be used for the people I love.
Right? Exactly, dude. And that's what it teaches. The daughters of Ferrix, it's almost as if that the name is like a nunnery, like a cloister, right? Where like they are officiating it and they're driving it. There's music, all these things, right? Yeah. And then when Marva has her final speech, it gets immediately disrupted by the Empire. It's like, nope, we can't do this. Can't say this stuff. Mm-hmm. And what happens? It's like, how dare you disrupt our most sacred ritual because of your homogenizing force? Now we're going to fight back.
Yeah.
You have crossed the line. Now we're going to fight back. And good ritual provides healthy defiance against these evil forces.
So. Yeah. Okay. First of all, I'll say I thought you were going off into your nerdy Eastern Orthodox ritualistic rant.
I am.
And I could not see at first. I could not see the connection to Andor. But I let it go, okay? And, dude, I think you're onto something here. I think you're totally right. Oh, man. This show keeps telling me how wrong I am about things.
It's okay, bro.
I think... Thank you. I think one of the most powerful aspects of rituals is that it tells you who you are.
Yes.
So
yes.
I'm telling you, this happens negatively and positively, right? Like the funerary ritual tells you who you are. You're a person, a citizen of Ferrix. Tells you that you'll be remembered. It tells you that what you did matters. All that stuff. But in Narkina 5 at the prison, that ritual imposed upon you by the prison guards, that ritual tells you that you're worthless. That you are a cog in the machine. They even tell you on program, which is some crazy futuristic nightmare where like your human beings are made into machines and the machines are just parts and the parts are used to make other parts. And then those parts are ultimately used to kill you in the end, you know, like, but the ritual, it means something. It tells you that you don't matter.
Hmm.
I mean, the fact that they're barefoot, you know?
Yeah. Yeah.
All of that, the fact that they're barefoot, the fact that they work 12-hour shifts, the fact that they have, you know, 7 floors, 7 rooms, 7 tables, 7 men per table, like all of that is symbolism, right?
Yeah.
But in the most like
good point
sick sense, not the usual sense, you know?
Yeah.
Because sin is always like an inversion of the good, right? Yeah. I think you're right, man. Rituals tell you who you are.
And you're right. I am going on my Orthodox rant. And so, I didn't want to bring it up, but in my journey thus far, I've converted to Orthodoxy. And well, I'll just leave it at that. And if people want to know more, then we'll talk
more
about
it. You started off as what? And now you are what?
Yeah, I started off, Korean Presbyterian. And I went through non-denominational, Pentecostal, even Catholic to a certain extent. And now I'm Orthodox. And so, And a lot of what I just shared about ritual is deeply rooted in that idea. There's a story. There was 12 hostages and there was a terrorist organization and they filmed it and they were going to behead all these 12 hostages. Now, these were Egyptian Coptic Christians, I believe. And 11 of them were and one wasn't. And they go to each one and they say, are you going to apostatize from Christianity and accept our religion? And the first person says no, and they behead him. Are you going to do it? No. They're going to behead him, and they go all the way to the 11th. Are you going to do it? No. And and they behead him, and then the 12th person, not Christian, he says, you got to behead me now, because what they've done is true. They're willing to die Why? Why are they willing to die for ideas? They're not ideas. There's something real about what they just did right now.
Yeah.
I want that truth. I want that. So you better kill me now. And that's what happened. Mm. And I've experienced divine liturgy. I've experienced orthodoxy in the little amount that I've experienced.
Yeah.
That ritual is powerful. It goes beyond understanding. It goes beyond intellect. That's something that's etched within you in the deep caverns of your soul that tells you that it's true. Again, yeah. Good Christian ritual, true Christian ritual is the superlative of all good rituals, whether secular or religious. And but I think when you're truly on board with it, there's something there that says, you know what? I will defy against empire. Yeah. I will stand against it, you know?
Yeah. So I think there's a parallel there's a parallel in Andor to this historical event that you just referred to, Simon. Nemec, this is the day before the robbery, right? Nemec tells him that he couldn't sleep. He's too nervous. And he says, I'm struggling to understand why my faith doesn't calm me. I believe in something. Mm-hmm. And yet I'm so unsettled. And yet you, Clem, you have nothing. He's not like being rude about it.
Yeah.
You have nothing. You sleep like a stone. And so you see here a true believer standing right next to an unbeliever, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, Nemec is assuming that Clem has no pure motive, but he does, right? I think Clem has experienced tragedy and loss because of the empire. But he hasn't come out to make a stand for it yet. I just see like through Nemec's sacrifice for the cause, eventually he's a huge factor, a big factor in Cassian's conversion. Same as the story of the 12th guy in your story, right? Like he's that person died for something real. And so he was willing to die for that as well by the end, after seeing all of the sacrifices that people have made. And also absorbing all of the losses that he's received, you know, like Cassian went through a journey and every event that he went through was a catastrophe. But after those catastrophes, like it shaped him and it formed him and it gave him a real reason for why he wants to fight back. Right. I love this story of this conversion, you know, like I think all of us go through a conversion where we start off, not really believing in something, and then we convert to something real, something true.
Right.
Do you remember that scene where it's the shady dude who wanted to run away with the 80,000 credits? You know?
He told him, hey, why don't we just make a run for it? And he shoots first. Andor shoots first. Yeah, okay.
Right.
I know who you're talking about.
So he has a speech here where like, don't judge me. He's talking to Cassian. You're not here to save anybody but yourself. You and I are the same. We were born in the hole, and all we know is climbing over somebody else to get out.
Wow.
I see that as ritual.
Okay.
Because at the simplest level, ritual is something you do over and over again. It's a pattern.
Right. Right.
And this shady dude here, I don't know what his name is, but he has made it a pattern in his life to climb over somebody else.
Yes.
He doesn't care about the morality of it. He still considers himself a rebel, but it's just him versus everyone else.
Mm.
That's his ritual. That's what he's done again and again.
Right.
And when you do something again and again, it just reinforces that you do it some more. And that's actually how sin works, and that's actually how holiness works, right? Like, the more we do something, the easier it gets to keep doing it again.
That's right.
So there's always hope and despair in our activities.
Right.
And I think the shady dude is right. He sees in Cassian that, at certain points of his life, Cassian was there to save nobody but himself. But he's wrong in the sense that even though Cassian started out that way, he's evolving and learning and changing. And I think that Cassian is growing a conscience. But before he grows that conscience, he has to experience real personal loss. He has to lose his mom and his freedom.
Yep. Yeah. The foundation of it.
Before he chooses a side, you know?
Right.
At the bottom of it, it is not wrong to try to climb out of the hole. Right? Climbing out of the hole.
Going back to the,
is good. And just like in the corporate sense, it's not wrong to climb a ladder. It's, but I think the one kind of metric by which we can judge this by is selfishness or selflessness, right?
Right, right.
I think Cassian, he's changing. He's realizing that
yes,
he's not a rebel fighting against the Empire, but in that moment when he shoots the shady dude, he decides that he's not going to be a selfish thief.
Right.
He takes his cut, he returns the Kyber crystal, and he leaves the rebellion the rest of the money.
Yeah.
He did his job. And this is the one milestone in his journey to converting to a real and full rebel. You know, he decides he's not going to be a thief. He's not going to be selfish, but he's not yet going to be a hero either. He's not going to lay his life down for it, you know? So rituals make you into something, you know? And he, and there's this grain of hope here where Cassian sees somebody else doing his ritual and he realizes, you know what? I've done that too. Climb over other people at their expense, but I'm not going to do it now. And then that leads to the next time when he acts selflessly again. And that selfless act leads to another selfless act, and it leads him to the greatest sacrifice of all at the end of Rogue One, you know? Yeah.
Wow. I appreciate you bringing that up. You're right. It's everyone does rituals. And that's what defines them. That's exactly right. And there's some really wicked rituals. And to counter those wicked rituals is holy rituals, right? And I will dare say what Cassian did at that moment, the reason why they're different is I would dare say it goes back to Marva. You know what I'm saying? That like there was something instilled in him through Marva that made him different than that guy. Cassian comes from a foundation of Marva's love. Right. And that's kind of where the fairness and the not being a thief comes from, I think. I think you're spot on.
Here's the thing, though. If you think about it, the only reference to love is from the mom, right? The mom is the only one who ever talks about love.
Yeah,
love
that's right.
Is totally devoid in the rest of the dialogue throughout the show.
Wow. That's good. Wow. I got to watch it again now to notice that, but that's good. That if that's the case, that then there's something that needs to be known about that.
Okay, think about two main characters in the show who are like leaders in the rebellion, right? I see one as Marva. Her motive, her foundation is love. She loves her son.
Yeah, that's right.
Loved her husband.
That's right.
She loves the daughters of Ferrix. She loves all of Ferrix, which I think is it's not just a city. It's a whole planet. Is that right?
Yeah.
She loves more than her social circle, right? Like,
yeah, exactly.
She has this altruistic, wide love, right? And the other major character of the rebellion is Luthen. We haven't talked about him yet. His speech on the bridge.
Yeah. Oh my gosh.
It's so crazy because his motives are not love.
No.
He's coming from a place, not of love, but of loss. He lost something so badly that he's willing to give up everything. Again, love causes you to sacrifice, but I think pain and hurt and anger.
Wow.
You're also willing to give up a lot too to get revenge.
Yeah. That's good. That's good.
And so his motives are not pure either, but they're both going for the same cause and they both have the same mission. And but their starting points are very different, you know?
Right.
And I might be one of those conspiracy theorists here now, but I watched one YouTube video that talked about how Luthen might be a former Jedi.
I was gonna bring that up.
It makes total sense.
It does. It does. Even if it's not true, to know that background, to emphasize how much Luthen lost and what he has become from that, it's so good. It is so good. Yes, but go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, he turns his back on the Force. Okay, that's a hypothesis, right? That he's a former Jedi.
Yeah.
He turns his back on the Force and he allows himself to hate. He allows himself to be vengeful. And I don't remember the exact words that he said, but he's like, he's turned himself from the light and now he just lives in darkness and he sees no future for himself, right?
That's right.
Because this is a suicide mission for him.
Yeah.
Sooner or later, he's going to die, but he's going to take him down. He's going to take as many people down as possible. Again, completely different motives from Marva.
Yeah.
This is also the other beauty about this show, Andor, is that the rebels aren't pure and the Empire isn't utterly evil either. You know, it's so gray.
Yes.
Morally gray.
Yeah, that's right.
And that means that it's more realistic to everyday life.
Exactly. So on point, B. because both have sacrificed. You're absolutely right. What makes Marva's sacrifice different than Luthen's sacrifice? And I think you nailed it. Luthen is sacrificing from hate. Marva is sacrificing from love. And when you sacrifice out of love, it's kenotic. It's kenosis. It's you're emptying yourself, but you maintain your humanness. And going back to what we said, our idea of humanness is the ultimate ideal for every person, because Jesus is the true human, right? So when we say I'm being human, I'm being more like Christ, right? And so when you sacrifice love, you're emptying yourself of old ways so that new ways can fill in, so that you can become a better human. You become more human. Luthen, sacrificing out of hate, is tearing his very essence away from him. He's not becoming himself. And here, I think this is a confirmation marker of that. Luthen is the only one that's duplicitous. He has two identities. No one else has that. No, even Mothma, the senator, she's struggling trying to do this duplicity, and it's hurting her. She's like struggling with it. But Luthen, it's like almost so comfortable being two different people. You know what I'm saying? And so his identity, his personality is being stripped, is being torn asunder.
Yeah.
But Marva is becoming more unified. You know what I'm saying? And so so everyone sacrifices, but if you sacrifice out of hate, you become less human. You become less like the person that God wants you to be, the creature that God wants you to be. But if you sacrifice out of love, like Marva, death, you're not even afraid of death. You'll go and say, I'll pass through death because I know the truth is that even death doesn't separate me from my creator. Yeah. You know what I'm saying? You become more human.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's so crazy. I actually Googled his monologue.
Oh, nice.
And the other guy, the spy, right? He's like, what have you sacrificed lately? And he says, what's my sacrifice? I'm condemned to use the tools of my enemy to defeat them. I burn my decency for someone else's future. I burn my life to make a sunrise that I know I'll never see. And so there's some kind of altruism here, right? Both Luthen and Marva want to provide a future for other people in other generations. Hmm. So they share the same end, but they don't share the same means.
Good. That's good.
Well, maybe they share the same means because they're both sacrificing their own lives. But it is hard to parse
the difference
between the two, because Marva is inciting a rebellion, right? And he's inciting a rebellion.
True.
But he does it through these shady back alley, duplicitous means, where she's transparent about what she's doing, you know?
He feels that he needs to fight the Empire like the Empire.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? So that's his catalyst, is that he feels that he needs to fight the Empire like the Empire. I think that's what makes him different than Marva. Marva says, I'm nothing like the Empire. And then so the means are the same, the ends are the same, but their starting points are different.
Yeah, right. Yeah, so earlier in the show, he was willing to sacrifice one of his teams in order to keep his spy in place.
Dude, that's nuts.
Dude, if he were truly a good guy, he would save each person, no matter the cost, right?
Yep.
But he was willing to burn them if it meant that he could have a foothold, an advantage. And there I see that he's used the tools of his enemy.
Yeah.
Right? And it means even more if he was a former Jedi, right?
Like, right.
That's the worst thing is when you use the evil and darkness to defeat evil and darkness, you know?
That's right.
But that's actually how sin works, right? Like sin convinces you that you can use horrible means to justify that you're doing good things.
Right.
And it's just, that's a line, you know, that's a line that I think all of us have to think about. Should we cross this line in order to achieve something that we believe is good and helpful?
Right.
And I think the difference between Marva here is that she encourages the citizens of Ferrix to fight, right? And Luthen, he obviously employs fighters. So they're both fighting, but there's a different quality to how they fight, you know? I don't know how to put it into words, but I think her fighting is more of a resistance and his fighting is more of like, I don't know, like...
Yeah.
There's something underhanded about how he fights.
Yes,
and so
exactly.
At first, as a Christian and as a person who believes in nonviolence, I don't always believe that fighting is the answer.
Right.
But maybe there's a way of fighting without just killing lives senselessly.
So little spoiler warning, maybe like an insight of what we were planning out to do the next episode on. But Dr. Joey Allen Lee is published. All right. As I want everyone to know that he's actually published, and I know that he's going to do more, but that first one must be an amazing feeling. And I just want to congratulate him publicly on his first publication.
I published a journal article. It's just 15 pages long, so it's not a big deal.
No, real. Don't say that. Don't self-deprecate, bro. We're going to lift you up. Okay. And, but it was about jujitsu, right? And how jujitsu conveys the transcendentals of goodness, beauty, and truth, correct?
Yep. Yeah.
Yep. So real world, one of the ideas of resisting or using violence in a nonviolent way, I think jujitsu teaches that, right? And like the idea is that instead of defending with a sense of wanting to kill, right, which often war happens and stuff like that happens, but jujitsu provides a way where an alternative can be provided, where it's just like, hey, I'm going to defend myself and I will defend myself with force, but my intentions of implementing those things is not for your loss. It's not for your, not to kill you. It's really to stop you, right? And so I think Brazilian jiu-jitsu kind of encapsulates that well in that ritual, you know? And so, but
yeah,
we'll talk more about that in another episode.
The journal article kind of questions, how do we fight evil without becoming evil ourselves?
Good. Wow.
And the way to do that is to do so nonviolently, meaning like, you know, we can defend ourselves, but we're not trying to kill anybody.
Right. Right.
And I in some ways see that that's how Marva incited her rebellion. Like, they weren't picking a fight, but when the empire comes to try to stamp them out of existence, like they're not going to lay down and be rolled over.
That's right.
And maybe this is the reason why Andor is such an intriguing show to me is that Luthen's method is he infiltrates the empire. He has spies everywhere. And he tries to break down the empire from within. But here's a big question ethically. Is Marva's method superior to Luthen's method? In some ways, I feel like you need both. You need somebody to do the dirty work. And you need somebody to do, you know, the noble work.
Right.
And maybe this is my human fallenness, that I don't have the imagination to think otherwise. But I'm pretty sure some of our listeners might even disagree with me. They might say that Luthen's method is inexcusable. You can't do that. But the show makes me wonder.
Yeah.
And because there's no real solid, clear-cut, black-and-white answer, it makes me think about it more. And that's part of the beauty of the show.
That's part of the beauty of the show. And I think that is something that we should leave off for our listeners. Any final thoughts before we go, Joey?
Maybe we just want to ask our audience, what do you think about how do we fight back against sin and evil in our context without losing our soul in the process?
Wow.
Yeah. I don't know. I don't know if I found the answer, but I'm going to try my best.
We're not really looking for a sugarcoat 5-cent answer, right? This is something that we need to struggle and talk about for a long time. So Andor brings it up and you're bringing it up too. That's something that we need to consider as a Christian community. So,
All right. This is great. Thank you so much for joining us, everybody. We're looking forward to the next podcast that we record. But until then, may the force be with you.